Hey True North, welcome again to another roundtable episode. I'm here with Jay, and we also have a new special guest, Sarah King. She's a licensed marriage and family therapist. So Sarah, thanks again for joining us for this episode.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. So, you know, given a lot of factors, I think our sermon series that we're currently going through at True North, and also just the nature of your work, we kind of just wanted to tackle the idea of counseling, especially in the Christian circles and in the church. And I guess before all of that, one kind of introductory question I wanted to ask is, what was your own journey into counseling? Like, what kind of drew you into it, and what steps did you have to take to become a licensed therapist?
Good question. So growing up, psychotherapy was for psychos. My parents would say, hey, you have to be like really crazy to ask for help, and you can't feel. Feelings are crazy. Feelings are not in your control. So keep it on the minimum, just work hard and get through it. So keeping that ingrained in my head and my heart, I didn't allow my emotions to feel or emotions to come out, which made me very angry. So growing up, I was pretty angry at the world, at my family, everyone. And then fast forward to college, I graduated. And then I got a job as a behavior therapist working with kids with autism.
Okay.
At that time, I was asking God, give me an opportunity where I can practice my patience.
Those are dangerous prayers, Sarah.
Right, right. Yeah. And God really answered in that way. And I worked with these wonderful kids, which I love the population. But as I was working with them, I noticed the parents and how heartbroken they were, how left out they felt, how the resources weren't really there for them. They were saying things like, how come my kid's not invited to birthday parties? Mm. How come, you know, they had their expectations of how their child's going to be, but with special needs, it really changes perspective on what kind of childhood they're going to have and what kind of parent you can be.
Sure.
So as they're sharing these things in the 5-minute snippets, as they're picking up their child from working with me, I said, okay, I want to do something that helps these parents. What could I possibly do? So during that time, I had some friends who were going to Western Seminary for marriage and family therapy. And they're like, hey, my school's awesome. You should come and like study MFT. And this was the time that I was in LA dating my husband long distance because he's born and raised here in San Jose. So I'm like, okay, how can I pitch it to my parents that I want to move up to NorCal? Not for just a guy, but like, okay, I could make it into grad school. So I kind of worded it like, hey, mom and dad, I want to go to grad school. And there's a great school in NorCal. Mm. And, you know, Paul lives there too. Mm-hmm. So I got into the grad school. That was all God too, because I didn't think I would be able to get in, but I did. And there's a requirement with that grad school that you have to get your own personal 30 hours of therapy. Mm. And I was like, really? I need to go to therapy in order to graduate? Like, yeah, 30 hours. I'm like, oh, man. Okay.
Is 30 hours long, like, in like the counseling world, or is it just, like, barely scratching the surface?
You know, it depends on who you are. But 30 sessions is pretty average.
Okay.
For someone who has, like, this checklist mindset of I need to take care of this, meet this goal, and get resolved for this is usually about 30 sessions.
Okay.
So I'm like, okay, I have to go. So I'll try it out. I'll probably stay surface level. And then first session I had with this therapist, I sit down and she asks, what brings you in? And I was like, I could give the answer of like, this is a school requirement, or I can actually do some work here. So I told her, yeah, this is my school requirement, but I think there's some things that I need to work with or work on. and all of my daddy issues, mommy issues, sister issues. I have an older sister. Those things just started to come out. And I realized, oh, therapy's not that bad because she's not judging me.
Mm.
She just wants to hear my story and provide a space where I could just be me and talk about me. So that was my experience with therapy, finishing my program. I said, this is what I want to do. Even jumping into the program, I was like, I don't know if I want to do this. Because you really have to commit. There's 3,000 field hours that you need to fulfill in your training before licensure.
How many years of work is that?
That's like 2.5 to 3 years.
Crazy. Okay. So you grinded to get to where you're at. Every therapist did, which I think a lot of people
seriously
don't know.
All the therapists out there, man, you did it.
Yeah. So like from that, I guess, and specifically because it's interesting because you went to a seminary for your education, and speaking as a pastor and just as a Christian too, and this is kind of a big question, and I just wanted to hear your general thoughts too, but especially as a Christian, a believer, how do you feel and how do you see that our faith in Christ and the gospel mm-hmm. and counseling men together? And I guess you can maybe even share some principles from seminary too.
Mm-hmm. God is the ultimate healer, right?
Yeah.
He really orchestrates everything in our life. So being able to say, God, I'm broken, I'm hurting, and then having him show up was something that I was really interested in doing in the work that I do. The reason I chose Western Seminary is because it's 1 year of theology and integration on top of 2 years of counseling courses. I purposely chose Western Seminary knowing, okay, I'm going to learn more about the word and how to come alongside people utilizing everything I know about my relationship with Christ and how to integrate faith into healing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So one of the things that you mentioned about your parents kind of having like this stigma, right? Like psychotherapy is only for psychos. Mm-hmm. And even for me, my earliest experience with a counselor was a court ordered anger management course that I had to go to, you know, to like a counselor. And so, you know, there's always that stigma and idea of like, oh, you only go to the doctor when you're sick, you know, and there was no such thing as like regular checkups for me, you know, mm-hmm. in an Asian family.
Even if you're sick, you sleep it off.
Exactly. Just some Robitussin, right? And some aspirin.
Some ice.
Yeah. So like for a lot of, what maybe second generation or 1.5 generation Asian Americans who are, you know, kind of in adulthood now, how would you advise them to get over kind of the cultural stigma that counseling or therapy might have, which would hinder them from actually seeking help?
This is a great question and a question that I usually get from my second gen clients who come in. First thing I say is, the first gen and the gens before that, they're in a survival mindset. Mm-hmm. They don't have time to think about mental health. Yeah. They need to survive. They need to grind and make money and put food on the table.
Mm.
Whereas their children have their foundational needs met by these hardworking parents. And now they can talk about feelings
mm-hmm.
and like have the opportunity to ask questions about mental health. So that's the difference between these generations, I feel like. So all of these thoughts about psychotherapy is for psychos. It's not just the fact that they may believe that. It could be many different factors of therapy is primarily taught and learned through white people, the Western culture. It's too expensive. Asking for help is not what you do. Your problem's not that bad.
Mm-hmm.
Even over spiritualization of, did you pray about it? Did you like mm-hmm. really pray about it?
Mm.
Yeah.
You know, those kind of things build on the stigma.
You know, what's interesting is like our parents' generation, they worked hard to provide a better life for, you know, our generation, the younger generation, right? And what they may not have realized is that their hard work is so that this generation can think about the things that they didn't have to think about, right? Emotions, their emotional intelligence, their you know, spirituality and emotional maturity and health and stuff. And so, like, it's kind of ironic that the very thing that they've been working for is the thing that they've stigmatized.
Exactly. And it becomes, I did it. See, yeah, you can do it.
Yeah. And not to like make light of their situation, I'm sure that they went through so much crazier things than we probably had to. But you mentioned that they're in a different mindset, a survival mindset. It is truly eye opening.
Yeah, that's really helpful to me too. And I guess I wanted to say this for later, but since we're already on the topic, like I think, you know, the majority of our church is actually North Asian American, and I think with that, in almost any immigrant family that you live in, whether it's Asian American or not, it brings a lot of past and, frankly, a lot of trauma for a lot of us. And again, not trying to blame the older generation, but it's just hard for a lot of us that were growing up in two cultures. And from that, like, how impactful do you think that type of past is to our current state? And the kind of attached question is, if it is, which I'm guessing it is, how do you address that? How would you advise Asian Americans and people with that type of past with their families to kind of move forward?
Oh. Ooh. Our past really does affect our current, and it might even affect our future, because we make our decisions according to our experiences. And if we have hurt in our past, we're going to make our decisions accordingly. What will be the safest decision for me? What will hurt me the least? All of those questions come in all decision making. So how we experience our past with trauma, with bad memories, is imagine like a wheel that turns in one direction. That's how memory works. But when trauma happens, it like creates a wedge, and then the circle no longer can go in one way. It goes back and forth, hitting this trauma.
So you get triggered. Like if anything kind of reminds you of that.
You said wedge. The key word. Yeah. The wedge equals trigger. And trigger doesn't have to be so apparent. It can be in anything. And no one can really discredit what trauma is, because your trauma is yours. You're in the car with someone, you get in a car accident, one person says like, oh, no big deal, brush it off. And the other person's like, I'm never going to get in a car ever again.
Yeah.
Same accident, happened at the same time, but different perspective. So no one can really judge, hey, this isn't traumatic enough. So with that said, as small as you feel that your trauma is, it might actually not be that small. And that becomes the chip on your shoulder. It becomes how you see relationships. It becomes how you see God and your relationship with God. Our traumatic experiences do happen for a reason, but they don't have to stay traumatic. How I see therapy is it's a space where you can safely explore your feelings, and it's self-discovery of, even though these things happen to me, I can still fill in the blank.
So like, we'll get into like seeing a counselor soon, which I think is really important, and kind of destigmatizing that process for our church. But, you know, even for just like an everyday, especially now in COVID when you're stuck at home, like what are some ways you would advise people at home, just kind of even on their own, to start tackling a lot of these issues? Because, you know, even like, you know, when you talked about the wedge and the wheel, I think one thing that kind of brought up in my mind was, I'm recently a parent of two newborn kids, and I always told myself, like, I'm not going to do the things that my mom and dad did, right? But then you just catch yourself, that's the only thing you kind of know. I mean, you might have watched movies, right? That's the only thing you know.
Yeah.
So you're kind of stuck oftentimes in whatever cycle that you experience, good or bad. So, yeah, I guess, you know, before seeing a counselor, and even after seeing a counselor, what are some things you would advise people to do to kind of start working on that process at home?
First is self-awareness. Ask yourself, are any things in my life, do they need to be different? Do I want them to be different? Do I want the way I build relationships to be different? Do I want family cycles of conflict to look different? That's just answer those questions. Do you want anything in your life to be different for the positive? Then you ask yourself, are there things in my way to make that happen? What are those things? Fear? Is it financial? Is it time? Is it resources or the lack of? Yeah.
So it sounds like a lot of like self-reflection, which oftentimes we're too quote unquote busy to do.
Or we reflect in a negative light, coming from a perspective of I'm not enough, I'm not worthy, I'm always going to be alone, or I'm not lovable. Those are the four core negative beliefs that I work with all of my clients. All of my clients. I'm going to say those again. I'm not worthy. I'm not blank enough. I'm alone or meant to be alone. I'm not lovable. If that's how you're seeing the world, of course your symptoms are going to be negative.
Now, with those four symptoms that you see within your clients, how do you think the church has failed in developing mature disciples who should be aware of the truthful answers to those questions, right? Like, I mean, the gospel tells us, you know, we're worthy in Christ. You know, like, I mean, there's just so many different truths that we can come from the gospel. Like, so how has the church failed in that? Is it mainly a church issue? Is it mainly a parenting issue? You know, what do you think?
I think there needs to be a collaboration in how to restore people. These core negative beliefs started way before the church. I feel like it starts in like age 5, 6, 7. When something happens and no one explains it to you, oh, it's because I wasn't good enough. Oh, I didn't get chosen for that team because I didn't blank enough. Oh, that friend no longer wants to spend time with me because I'm not worthy of their time. If no one explains anything, we try to justify with a negative perspective because that's our sinful nature.
Yeah.
And it's also for Koreans, reverse psychology. Think of the worst so that you'll somehow be motivated by it to do the best. Like telling these students, like, oh, study hard. If you're not studying, then you're going to fail. And if you fail, then you're going to become homeless.
Yeah.
And for that child, imagine how they're thinking, oh my goodness, I'm going to be homeless is what they're going to hold on to. Not, oh, okay, then I should, you know, study some more and get good grades. They're not going to hold on to that part. They're going to hold on to, oh, you think I'm going to be homeless?
Yeah. Or even just like, you know, I work so hard so that you can get a good education. So if you're not getting a good education, then all this hard work from your dad or your mom is going to waste, right?
Man, isn't that the generational shame?
Yeah.
For sure.
So, you know, Sarah, one other question. One of the things that I'm encountering a lot during this COVID season is a lot of young people are getting engaged. And, you know, I am doing quite a few number of premarital counseling.
Oh, now, yeah, me too.
Yeah, and again, I am not trained to be a premarital counselor. You know, I'm trained to be a pastor. But every time I start it, I always say, one of the best things that you can spend money on the first year of marriage is go see a licensed therapist or counselor. And I say it fervently and with a lot of vigor, but I know no one takes up that advice, you know. So if you can speak to maybe recently married couples or people who are thinking of getting married, what is the value of seeing, you know, a counselor, especially in that first year of marriage or even, you know, before marriage?
I could even speak about my own personal life with my husband. We did get premarital counseling, but from a biblical perspective. And as I do my premarital contacts with my clients, what I realize is like feelings come and go. Even love could be a feeling that loves and that comes and goes. But do you really have the foundational things that you could bounce off of after a fight? Do you even know how this person will react in a fight? And what if one's a pursuer and then the other one's an avoider? What if they both have abandonment issues in that? How to resolve conflict is something we don't like to talk about, but are expected to know once you get married? Yeah. No.
Or even as a Christian, right? People just assume if you're a Christian, you should know these things.
Right. There are topics that we as Christians don't even talk about, especially like sex, child rearing. Mm-hmm. How are you going to raise them? And like temptation, what do you do with that? If you were saving yourself until marriage and then you get married and then the sex is not what you expect it to be.
Yeah.
Or there's this sinful feeling,
yeah,
even though you're married. Mm-hmm. That's real. For a lot of my newly married couples, that topic of like the sinful feeling, even though we're married, you can't really talk about that with just everyone.
Yeah. Especially with the pastor sometimes.
Especially with the pastor. Yeah. And it sounds like you can't, because I always hear people say, like, because I think Jay and I have both encountered people that we know is above our pay grade in terms of, you know, we can give them scripture and we'll pray for them, mm-hmm, but there's deeper issues. And they always say, we can figure it out on our own, or, oh, I don't need counseling. Right.
Yeah.
And it sounds like what you're saying is like, oftentimes you don't know what you need when you're in the thick of it. Like there's no way you'll know. It's like, how will you know? Cause you're fighting with those instincts that you said. Mm-hmm. So I guess a bigger question is, and this is including, you know, married couples, family, singles, just anyone in the church, and really anyone listening to this right now. And a kind of a trick question, because I think I know what you'll answer, but I think it needs to be said. When should you seek counseling in any type of stage of life that you're in?
Anytime.
So,
because,
yeah, uh-huh, go ahead.
There will never be a perfect time for you to go to counseling.
Hmm.
I chose to go to counseling because I had to for my graduate degree. There will never be the right time for you to go. Mm. And the first session that you sign up for will be the hardest one. Definitely. But if you could make a commitment to yourself to see if it could help, see if there's some healing that needs to be done.
Yeah.
Sign up.
Yeah.
Just call someone. And I give free consultation. 15 minutes to talk to me. Like I'm an actual person. I'm not with the glasses and with a clipboard trying to judge you.
Do you have to lay down on a sofa when we're talking to you or anything? No.
I do have a couch.
Nice.
I'm not here to judge you. I'm here to see, are there ways that we can make your life a little more peaceful?
Hmm.
Are there traumas that are just stuck and your brain's too scared to reach it? Are there prayers that you felt like you've prayed for so long and yet there's silence? Do you just need a safe space in order for you to feel and to just cry?
Yeah.
So I think one thing that could be helpful is I because for me, I guess like personal testimony, like when I went to seminary, there was a small class on like how counseling is important. But, you know, for me, I'm a big thinker. I don't consider myself emotional. So I was never really turned on to it. And, you know, when I got married and when we're fighting, we're like, it's fine. We can figure it out. And I remember like a lot of it was just like the shame of like, man, if I go to counseling, I'm like, I'm that broken pastor. I'm that broken husband, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, can you maybe speak into that? Like what, how can we break down that stigma? And maybe even further on, like practically, this could be helpful. Like what should we expect? You know, maybe in the first session too? Cause I think that kind of helps break down the shame of like, But like you said, it's not someone judging you. It's someone listening to you for the first time.
Legally, you seeing me is confidential.
Mm.
No one will legally know. Okay, that's one. Next is like, if you feel that you got a handle on it, that's great. But do you notice the constant headaches or like the stomach pains or like the snapping that you do or the constant cycle of conflict that happens over and over about the same topic, but it's not really the same topic, but it is?
Mm.
There are things that as humans, we love patterns, but if your pattern is a negative pattern or a conflict pattern, what if there's a way to reverse it?
Mm.
What if you don't have to struggle in that same conflict anymore? Yeah. It's just a question I'd like you to ask yourself. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, no, I think that's really, really helpful. Maybe even like getting more practical. Like if I do, I don't know if you're legally allowed to say this or not, but if I do sign up for a consultation, mm-hmm. like what would literally that first session look like? Because I think for a lot of people, there's that fear of the unknown stops them. Yeah. So maybe even like spelling out exactly this is what it's going to look like could be helpful for some people.
So 15 minutes will usually be over the phone. And I ask you, hey, what brings you in? And why now? Did anything happen recently in order for you to give you to give you that extra push to call me now?
Hmm.
And if this person says like, oh, you know, life is hard. There's a lot of things going on. Like, you know, the pandemic, it's my friends.
Yeah.
This is real. Mm-hmm. I recently had a conversation like this. Like, you know, I don't know why I'm really calling, but maybe I just want to see what you have in store for me, if you can help. Hmm. At first, I'm kind of like, okay, I'm not really sure why you're calling. But let's see where this goes. Mm. I do a drawing that lists out 5 fears. And these fears, when activated, takes that lens of core negative belief and then becomes symptoms. I do this drawing on the whiteboard for them. And a lot of the times, they're like, oh, that's exactly what I'm going through.
Mm.
Like, oh, that makes sense. You already have everything within you to feel better, but sometimes it could just be disorganized. Especially for your the heady people. You stay in your left brain so long that logic no longer can make sense regarding things that are getting stuck, because that's about emotions.
Mm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, that's really helpful.
You know, one question I have, you know, as you know, kind of going back to what Eugene was saying, you know, where, you know, Eugene said he's a thinker.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, emotions was not something that he was really focusing a lot on.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in a generation where emotions were connected to weakness, you know, so, you know, you don't want to be the emo guy or the sensitive one, you know, as I've gotten older, I've realized that, you know, being a thinker and being emotional, they're not mutually exclusive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in some ways it kind of elevates the other, one or the other, right? And also some of the most strongest people I've known are the people who are emotionally healthy.
Oh, come on. Yeah.
So maybe the question I have is, why is it that we as a culture and as a people have associated emotions with such a negative connotation when God has created us to be, you know, thinkers and emotion, you know, like mind, body, and soul, right? And so, what is the thing that drives us into that sort of negative thinking and logic?
Mm. Society driving big boys don't cry.
Mm.
Emotions are not controllable, whereas logic is.
Mm.
It's the sense of control that we're always seeking. Emotions may feel irrational, so you don't ever want to be irrational. You always want to be in control.
Mm-hmm.
How we see it, how I see it, is vulnerability equals courage, and that's what Brené Brown said, and she studies shame. Mm-hmm. And she says vulnerability equals courage because you need courage in order to be vulnerable as much as you need vulnerability in order to be courageous. Mm. And you hit the nail on the head. We are created in God's image. We are to be like him. He created emotions, mm-hmm. not for us to suppress, but for us to actually experience and express. So why as a society do we try to suppress our emotions? Because feelings get in the way of getting things done. Feelings stop us from reaching goals, which is completely not true. But society pushes that.
Yeah, I mean, I can even be like a personal testament to that too, because like I said before, like I always prided myself in the Myers-Briggs. Like I don't know about the other letters, but I'm a T. That's what I always told people. And
I'm an F, so
yeah. And it's funny because my wife is like the exact opposite of me, but I guess that could be another episode. But I think like I've realized
we should have our own counseling session right here.
But I realized like when I saw a counselor on my own that a lot of what I perceived to be, I mean, honestly, that Myers-Briggs stuff, it's not who you are, it's who you want to be ultimately. That's what the counselor told me kind of. And a lot of, not all the times, but a lot of times, yeah, I wanted to be a T because of some emotional scarring from before, right? And how I see it is that counseling kind of helps both people in my mind. And you can correct me if I'm wrong, Sarah, but I realized when I go see counseling as a thinker, I'm forced to finally think about my emotions. But for a lot of feelers, you go into a counseling and they kind of organize your emotions in a logical way that's a little more accessible. And that's why I'm always like, yeah, I don't think counseling, and I'm speaking to this as like a big T still. I pride myself in that. I love that I'm a T, but I think, yeah, counseling still serves you and maybe even more than an F because you've never had that side kind of unveiled in your own life too. So I kind of just kind of to reassure what everything Sarah's saying, I'm a product of that, and I found it to be helpful as a Christian especially too.
Something that I tell my clients all the time is when you connect your head to your heart, when your thinking connects with your emotions is when you're most authentically you.
Yeah, you know, one of the questions that I have during the pandemic is a lot of families with children, especially in their marriage, seem to be having a much more difficult time. And you know, different life stages have different hardships. And most of them are going to be, you know, around my age or a little older.
Yeah.
Meaning that they're a little bit more old school in their thinking. They might have even more reservations about seeing counseling or seeing a therapist. What would be some advice for, you know, kind of my generation and older, you know, maybe kids in elementary, junior high, high school? What would be kind of their, what would be an advice for their marriage specifically during this time?
Give yourself grace. Give your partner grace. Spend time with God alone. Spend time with God together. Find accountability outside of your marriage. Find accountability within your marriage. Create a routine just for yourself and create a routine for your family.
Okay. I feel like we should be paying Sarah for this.
Even just that, that's like we got to unlock like a price feature. Like, if you want, Patreon. If you want the podcast to reveal these truths,
It sounds like a lot of habits and routines that are healthy. Like, and rather just kind of like letting the flow of life dictate your family is helpful. I think that's really good. And I guess another question to add on is, I'm a little younger and a lot of people my age range, although I'm married, aren't married. So for a lot of the single kind of maybe millennial Gen Z right now that are in COVID, it's, I think, a crazy time for them because, you know, for a lot of us that are married and have kids, like most of our, and I'm not speaking for everyone, most of our jobs are kind of secure.
Yeah.
For a lot of these people, maybe they're losing a job and maybe they're looking for a job during the pandemic and they're just like going insane at home by themselves. I've talked to a lot of people, you know, that don't have, you know, we complain about our families a lot as married couples, but in the end of the day, they're there for you, whether you like it or not, and whether they like it or not. But for a lot of the singles at our church, especially, they've come to me and saying, I feel so alone right now. My roommates are isolated and just kind of on our own. So what are some advice and habits you would give to the kind of younger crowd going into this pandemic?
Journal about your feelings. No filter. Write it all down. And whatever you do with that piece of paper or journal is up to you. But writing it down organizes a lot of the floating thoughts, which can ease your anxiety. And know that loneliness is real. But you're never alone. God is with you. But you also have to have a time of honoring loneliness. So that when we do meet our Heavenly Father, we know the opposite of His presence and His companionship.
I've never really heard that. Can you speak into that more, like honoring loneliness? Like what would that look like for us practically to do?
What is it that God is trying to teach you during this time of solitude?
I see.
Not why am I so lonely? God, why are you putting me through this? Besides the why, which are also great questions to ask, the what could actually be the good question to ask too.
So it's almost like switching the questions you're asking yourself, because both those questions are valid. But I think the what questions God can actually answer here, and the why he'll eventually answer. I find that to be extremely helpful.
I mean, the why question comes from a position of entitlement, right? Because this isn't supposed to be happening to me. You know, so why is it happening to me? As opposed to, what is it that you're trying to teach me? It comes from more of a place of humility. So that's great advice. So one of the things that you mentioned about your role as a counselor and a therapist is to provide a safe place for people to really, for self-discovery, correct? What I've noticed within church or Christians is it seems like when anyone tries to get vulnerable or is reaching out, it feels more like a tribunal of judgment as opposed to a safe space where people can really carry one another's burdens. What's some advice to the church that you can give you know, just Christians about, like, how can we better help one another and serve one another in a way where we're not actually stifling true vulnerable sharing?
When judgment happens, I see it as there's a discomfort or there's a place of, oh, I don't want to not help you, or I don't want to be in a position where I can't help you, so I'm just going to shut it down. Or I'm going to judge it. So if you yourself find yourself judging someone else for their emotions, truly ask yourself, what is it that you're judging? Do you think feelings are weakness? If so, where did that come from?
What are some advice that you can give Christians to become better listeners when people are coming with their pains and their hurts?
You can ask the person, hey, what's your intention in asking me or telling me this right now? Because I could either help you fix it or I could just listen. I just need a little clarification of what you're needing from me.
I feel like this is sound advice for married couples as well.
Because
most of the time, you know, we just need a hug.
Yeah. Most of the times I assume I'm trying to fix what my wife's telling me. And she says, wait, no. I just need you to listen. Oh, my bad. I think that's really helpful.
There's power in listening, and there's power in sharing. I feel like if you share your woes, it gets cut in half. And if you share your joys, it multiplies.
No, that's great. I feel like I was counseled for the past couple of, maybe like 40 minutes we've been recording. So thank you so much, Sarah, for coming on. I guess to end really quick, I think we can all push people to find a therapist, but someone like you that we've had on and like we are comfortable with, is there ways that people can contact you about counseling, about an introductory session?
Yeah, you could give me an email. at cccsarahking@gmail.com. Or you can also find me on my website, cccsanjose.com/king. Or just Christian Counseling Center, San Jose, and we're the first website that shows up. You can look me up at Sarah King.
Awesome. Yeah, I think we highly recommend anyone listening, whether it's Sarah, which we highly recommend, but any counselor, to take some time to kind of just sift through your thoughts. I hope this episode was evidence for that. But yeah, Sarah, thank you so much for joining Jay and I for a couple of good moments in talking.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thanks, Sarah.